on The Bookshelf with your host, Dave Doc Kirby.
Regular listens to On the Bookshelf have heard me talking before about redlining, about gentrification, and so forth, but I would imagine that most of us don't really know very much about the people who actually live in Washington, D.C. Do you know how the people who live in Washington, D.C. are represented? Do they have a mayor and city council? Do they make all their own decisions? Or is there somebody else that's in charge of them? And what has happened through the last couple of decades that's changed the nature of places where African Americans could live? We're going to talk about these things and many more. We welcome to On the Bookshelf Tanya Maria Golash Boza, the author of Before Gentrification, The Creation of DC's Racial Wealth Gap. It's from the University of California Press. She is the executive director of the University of California Washington Center and professor of sociology at the University of California Merced, and is author of 5 previous books. Tanya, thank you so much for making time to be with us today on The Bookshelf.
Thank you, Doc. It's great to be here.
I would imagine that there are some civics lessons that we need to add in at this point, because I really didn't know, honestly, who's in charge of what in Washington, D.C., because it's kind of an anomaly as cities go in America, right?
Absolutely. It's an anomaly because it's a city, and we're not in a state. But as a city, we operate as a city. We operate as a county, and we have to do some things that a state does, but we do all of this without any of the full powers that any of those other bodies might have.
So, in other words, if the city council decides we're going to make it, I'll just pick something absurd, illegal for people to drink soft drinks out of cans in outdoor markets, that would not just be their decision.
Right. They would have to then, that would then be reviewed by Congress. And actually, that's the reason that Congress gives, that, you know, D.C. might try and make some crazy law that's not in the interest of national security, like outlawing soda cans, and then Congress would overturn that decision. So Congress regularly overturns laws that are passed, you know, bills that are turned into, the bills that city council tries to pass to turn into law. Congress says, nope, we're not going to approve that.
I will say that it doesn't seem to matter who's running things. When Congress wants to make decisions, they make those decisions, and they don't particularly ask, well, what do you people who live in Washington, D.C., how do you feel about this? I get the impression that that's never particularly on their mind.
It's not. I mean, there are hearings, right? So D.C. residents and people active in D.C. definitely go to Congress, and there are hearings. But even when, you know, Congress hears strongly from D.C. that we really want to pass this bill, Congress denies it on a fairly regular basis.
First of all, that's got to be extraordinarily frustrating. And how in the world can you actually govern yourself if you're always much more tightly controlled by the U.S. Congress than the vast majority of people in the rest of the cities across the nation? We're fairly autonomous, and as long as we don't go up against state law, we generally can do whatever we want to. And if people don't like it, then they vote them out, which is democracy, right?
Right, exactly. And the thing about democracy is Washington, D.C. is, like many cities, is overwhelmingly Democrat. But Congress is usually about 50% Republican, 50% Democrat. So the people that are making the decisions about the laws that we pass in the city don't necessarily represent, you know, the interests of the city or have the same values and outlook as residents of the city.
Let's talk a little bit about gentrification, usually intended to mean people with money have bought up places in cities that used to be nice and now aren't nice, and they're going to make them nice again.
I mean, to some extent, I mean, gentrification itself really does just mean the gentry, which is middle-class people moving into a neighborhood that has been disinvested. So the concept is the same, right? You have people who are middle-class with more resources moving into a neighborhood that's been disinvested. That generally is what gentrification means. What I explain in the book are many things. One of them is, like, how did the nation's capital become a place that could be gentrified? So why is it, as you said, not so nice anymore? What happened to the nation's capital that it got to a point where it was disinvested? Because the only way you can gentrify a place is once it's actually become disinvested.
Right. Now, I was surprised to read there has been a dramatic change in the type of ownership of places to live over the last, say, 70 years, let's say the post-World War II era in Washington, D.C. Give us some background on that. That redlining was going on in D.C. in those days, just like it did in Chicago and a lot of the other major cities. It's basically, an FHA says, there are some places that aren't as likely to be very nice, so we'll make sure that they don't get any money. They're not eligible for loans and such to get nicer. Whereas these other places where people have more money, we can loan them money because they're like us, or they're more likely to pay us back, or for whatever their rationale was.
The caveat is just that that changes over time. So let me tell you one story about a neighborhood in D.C. just to sort of understand how a neighborhood can go from being green line to red line to disinvested to gentrified. And when it's gentrified, it's no longer red line. Now it's green lined again. So
right.
Kind of thinking about how that happens. So there's a neighborhood on just outside the central city in Washington, D.C. called Petworth, which is where I grew up. And that neighborhood was built mostly in the 1920s and 1930s and 1940s. And it is a neighborhood with, like, big streets, with tree-lined boulevards, with brick homes. And the neighborhood was built by a series of developers. And when they built the neighborhood, they had a very specific population in mind. They built those homes for white residents. So what the developers did is when they built the homes, they put covenants in the deeds that said these homes shall not be sold to a Negro or colored person, the language that they used at the time to refer to African Americans. So basically the neighborhood was built only for whites, and when the FHA came along and did their redlining or greenlining, they looked at the neighborhood and they said, oh yeah, this neighborhood looks like a stable white middle class neighborhood, so we're going to give it a green line for investment. And so it was originally built not at all as a red line neighborhood. But then in 1948, the Supreme Court decided that those racially restrictive covenants were not legally enforceable. So although the covenants remained in the deeds, they weren't stricken out, they now said, okay, you can't say you can't sell a house to a black person. So with that decision, black people were able to purchase those homes, but we didn't see a lot of black people purchasing those homes in 1948 because there weren't that many for sale. Most of those white people had just moved into those homes, you know, and they were raising their families, and they didn't see any good reason to leave, so they didn't sell very many homes to black people. But in 1954, the Supreme Court made another big decision, which is school desegregation. So as of September 1954, the schools in that neighborhood, which had been 100% white because they were legally segregated, now became desegregated, so black people could enroll their children in those schools. And as soon as black people began to enroll their children in those schools, white people began to leave en masse. So white people began to sell their homes very, very quickly, and black people were the ones that wanted to purchase those homes, and because there was super overcrowding in the black areas of the city, which had previously been redlined. So black people began to purchase these homes, and that neighborhood, over the course of 20 years, so between 1954 and 1974, really in the course of 10 years, just went from 100% white to about 90% black. Nearly every single person that moved in was black, and nearly every single person that moved in, that moved out was white. And that neighborhood also was a primarily home ownership neighborhood, so most of the white people that lived there owned their homes, most of the black people that moved in owned their homes. So that neighborhood went from being a white middle-class neighborhood to a black middle-class neighborhood. So by the 1960s, it was a primarily black middle-class neighborhood. The schools that were desegregated were excellent schools. They were still providing a stellar education to students, sending many of their graduates to Oberlin, to Harvard, to Howard, and to schools all across the United States. But what happened is, as that neighborhood became majority black, it did then become informally redlined. And what that means is, as the delis, you know, that had previously served white residents were started closing down, as the drug stores and the grocery stores started closing down, black business owners had trouble getting loans to open new restaurants and new delis in those neighborhoods. So those neighborhoods became redlined. It became harder to get financing to fix up homes, became harder to get financing to open small businesses. So slowly, you know, between like 1960 and by 1975, the neighborhood looked completely different. It didn't have as many small businesses. It didn't have as many grocery stores. And the schools also experienced disinvestment. So the school system, which had about 100,000 residents in 1954, by 1964 now had 150,000 residents. And Congress, as we mentioned before, Congress appropriated the money for D.C. schools at that time. Congress didn't appropriate any additional funds, really, to support this huge influx of students. So the schools became disinvested. the neighborhood became disinvested, and over time that neighborhood transferred from this solidly middle-class neighborhood with great resources to a neighborhood that was still majority homeowner and still had many middle-class residents, but just didn't have the same amenities that it previously had, and then it experienced an outflowing of residents. People began to leave, began to move out to the suburbs where they could find better amenities. And then the neighborhood also began to experience problems in the aftermath of the Vietnam War. We had a lot of people coming back to the neighborhood addicted to drugs, you know, people had served in the Vietnam War. And so the neighborhood, and then we also had an unemployment crisis in the 1980s. So that neighborhood previously had very low rates of unemployment. Now it had high rates of unemployment. All of this conspired to create a situation where the neighborhood was beginning to face a crisis. As the neighborhood was facing a crisis, the city still was not investing in improving the neighborhood. But once crime began to increase and once crime became a national agenda item, then the city decided to invest in the neighborhood. And that investment was primarily in terms of more police and more prisons. But the city didn't make the investments that needed to make in community centers and libraries and schools. Instead, it invested mostly in policing. And then that, you know, just compounded the crisis in the neighborhood. So then that all of that conspired to make the neighborhood one that could be gentrified. The 21st century began to be gentrified.
You know, the problem is once things get to a tipping point, when enough of the businesses and enough of the stores moved away, then you just don't have the tax base.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so you can't go to the DC's case. They can't go to the city fathers and say, okay, we need to do something to improve these neighborhoods and we need to invest in the neighborhoods. And the city doesn't have the authority to spend the money. They have to get it okay by Congress. This, to me, is one of the biggest problems with the situation, is that there always has to be this oversight from people who really have nothing to do with it. I mean, people who work in D.C., frankly, no matter which party they're in, don't seem to really care very much about the folks that live in D.C., because I don't think very many of them do. I think they live in big suburbs in other places, in Connecticut, and places that they can move, and then they can just commute in and out. There doesn't seem to be a lot of connection between the Congress and the people they supposedly represent in the first place. What would it take for D.C. to have some autonomy and making the kind of decisions that would have shortchanged this decline?
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of options for D.C. that have been proposed. One option that people propose is to just make, there's a very small downtown area where Congress is, you know, in the White House, to make that the federal city. Like, okay, that can be the federal city. Like, it makes sense perhaps for the government to have a federal city, but we could just make that the federal city, and the rest of D.C. could become its own state. So there's definitely a movement for statehood of D.C., which would then allow, you know, Washington, D.C. to make all of the decisions that any other, you know, state or any other body would make. Of course, the opposition to that is that the state, like I said earlier, would be definitely Democrat, because the residents of D.C. are currently almost all Democrat, and then that would bring two additional senators, Democratic senators, to Congress. So that's the main reason that the D.C. statehood movement doesn't gain a lot of traction is, you know, there's 50% of people in the country don't really want to see two additional Democratic senators in the Congress.
Even if they weren't treated as a state, because they're not a state, if just giving them the autonomy of being able to make their own decisions would be a step in the right direction. And then maybe, let's say, if you're a resident of Washington, D.C., you're a resident of a city that's between states.
Mm-hmm.
Why not? Because that land came from two different states mm-hmm. previously.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to vote in Virginia, if you want to consider you're a state resident of Virginia, that way you can vote for a member of the House of Representatives, or you can be a resident of Maryland. Either way, that way you would be represented by members of Congress, oversee our needs, or would we have to just dissolve the district in order to be able to do that?
I mean, it probably is feasible. I think it probably would change the number of representatives in the House of Representatives, just because there's 700,000 people living in D.C.
Sure,
I don't
yeah.
know the exact calculation, but I think it's certainly feasible. Certainly is a feasible option, but again, that wouldn't change the Senate, but it would change the House.
Right.
And
right.
D.C. does, just for people that don't know, D.C. does have a representative in Congress, but they're a non-voting representative.
It doesn't seem like if you're a member of an organization, but you're just basically an observer, that really does very much good for D.C.
Yeah, I mean, most D.C. residents don't think it's that very much good.
I can imagine not. In case you're joining us really late, we're talking to Tanya Gulash Boza, who is the author of Before Gentrification, The Creation of D.C.'s Racial Wealth Gap, which is published by the University of California Press, and you can check their website, ucpress.edu, for more information on this book and other fine publications. How many neighborhoods are there?
Yeah, well, there's about 40 different neighborhoods in D.C., each with their own character, and
wow.
About 700,000 residents, about 45% of whom are African American.
Okay, now one of the things that you talk about in the book is home rule for D.C. in the 1970s. Because the city is majority black, then the mayor, the police chief, and so forth were black, and 35% of city contracts went to minority-owned businesses, which should have all been good things. The drug situation had gotten so serious by the late 1970s that it seems that they supported the get-tough-on-crime sort of mentality as well. And I remember reading a book, one of the books that you referenced in here, the Privilege of Interviewing, several years ago, and that's one of the things that he talked about, that once it got to a certain point, that everybody was in favor of getting tough on crime because they were the victims of the crimes. The crimes were occurring in their neighborhoods, and they wanted something done about it. But this just exacerbated the problem.
Yeah, so I had the opportunity to review the archives of neighborhood, primarily African-American neighborhood organizations in the early 1980s. And what I saw is, yes, they absolutely were demanding more policing and getting more tough on crime. But they also were asking for liquor stores to be closed down. They were asking for more investment in schools. They were asking for more community centers, for drug treatment centers. So they were making all these asks, but only the call for more policing in prisons was answered.
It's easier to say, well, we'll just hire more police, and we'll give you more money to hire police, because then you as a legislator think, well, I'm giving people jobs. They're even working as prison guards, or they're working as police officers, and those guys are going to like me, and they're going to vote for me next time. Now, D.C. doesn't have its own prison system, so what happens if you get arrested in Washington, D.C., and you get sent to jail or sent to prison? Where do you go?
Yeah, well, the first thing to know is if you get arrested in Washington, D.C., you get taken down to the courthouse, and you can either be prosecuted under federal law or under state law. Now, of course, that's anywhere, but in D.C., it's very, they're both in the courthouse, and either of them could choose to prosecute you, and you can be prosecuted under either code. But let's say you're prosecuted under the D.C. code. Well, then if you are sentenced to prison at the end of your trial, you will be sent to a federal facility, because Washington, D.C. does not have its own prison system. And if you're lucky, you'll get sent to a prison about 150 miles away, but if you're unlucky, you could be sent to a prison as far away as California or Memphis, Tennessee, or Colorado, really anywhere in the United States.
Wow. Why don't they have their own prison? They just, because people don't want to think that Washington, D.C. needs its own prison?
No, we had our own prison. So what happened is in 1997, Congress took control of D.C.'s budget, took it back from D.C. They gave us control of the budget, they took it back, and they said, you know what, you guys are messing up. We don't like what you're doing with the budget. And they took a close look at it, and they were like, oh, well, yeah, I can see how you have trouble financing the city, because you're not allowed to tax 43% of your land, and we also don't allow you to impose a commuter tax, and there's all these rules. The federal government puts a lot of taxing restrictions on the city.
Right.
So they were like, yeah, I can see why it's hard to balance your budget. Okay, we're going to help you out in some ways. And one of the ways that Congress decided to help D.C. out was like, well, we'll just take over corrections, because that will save you a lot of money. So the idea, it was a way to help D.C. Balance its budget. So that law was passed in 1997, and then as of 2001, the local prison was closed.
So how did that work out for the city? Did the city save tons of money, or did it just make everything worse?
I mean, the city saved money. This was part of the effort to renew investment in the city. So it has reduced the fiscal burden on the city by us not having to pay for prisons, for sure. It definitely did in the school. And the city has invested more money in the school system and in the community center. So the city has experienced the benefits of reinvestment that it didn't, in the 21st century, that it didn't see in the 20th century.
Do you see some things that are changing? You took a bike ride around D.C. for your research, mm-hmm. and found that there are beautiful schools and libraries being built well, over the district in both poor and affluent neighborhoods. Is that good news, or is it too little too late?
I mean, it is good news. It is very nice to go to some of the low-income, predominantly African-American of the areas of the city and see these just tremendous feats of architecture. You know, really, really beautiful libraries designed by David Ajay, who also designed the National Museum of African-American History and Culture. So it is nice to see additional public investment in majority black neighborhoods. However, there also is there continues to be significant disparities in terms of investment overall in neighborhoods depending on their racial composition. So there's an area south of downtown called Navy Yard that was redlined in the 1930s and 40s, and it was demolished, and they built public housing, and it just was kind of devastated for a long time. But that whole neighborhood was demolished again in the early 2000s, and it was built anew. So it is a beautiful, beautiful space. However, before being demolished, that neighborhood was 95% African American, and today it's about 15% African American. So there's definitely a feeling among D.C. residents that the city has become more beautiful, but not for the long-term residents of D.C. It's for the new people that are moving in, because there's other neighborhoods that you go to that continue to be predominantly African-American, and you don't see that level of investment. There might be a new library there, there might be a new school, but you don't see the level of public and private investment that you see in the neighborhoods that have become majority white.
Now, a tough question. This is a phrase that you used, and I'd like for you to explain it, about dismantling racism, I get that, and dismantling capitalism. So what exactly do you mean? Or do you mean like doing away with capitalism? Are you replacing it with something else or making it better? Or what exactly do you mean?
Okay, so one of the issues that we face in D.C. and around the country, really, is the fact that when we think about, you know, why are businesses deciding to put restaurants in certain neighborhoods? Why are people, you know, buying homes and then reselling them for a profit? And why are we making all of these decisions primarily based on the profit potential? So what we see in the history of the United States is that people make decisions based on the amount of money that they think they can make on a transaction. But that perception is always influenced by race, right? So if we're going to have, for example, if you think, okay, I'm going to buy this house in this neighborhood because I think it's going to increase in value, that whether or not you think that house is going to increase in value is always going to be based on the racial composition of the neighborhood, because the racial composition of the neighborhood affects how much the house is worth. So basically, we make decisions about where to house people, what kinds of amenities people should have, based on profit potential. So I believe that we should make decisions about where people should live, what kind of amenities they should have, not based on profit potential, but based on the fact that people are human beings, and every human being deserves a place to live. So you shouldn't only get a house because I can make money off of you getting a house. You should get a house because you're a human being. So under capitalism, we make decisions based on profit, but I think we should make decisions based on humanity.
And how would that work? I mean, are we talking about socialism or communism? Because kind of seeming like that's what we're talking about.
Yeah, so if we, a system where we eliminate private property and we eliminate the wage system, that would be communism. So that communism is one alternative to capitalism.
And do we think that's a good alternative? Have you seen countries where there's communism?
I have seen countries where there's communism, and I've seen countries where there's capitalism, and I've seen suffering in both places.
Yeah, I've been to Cuba. One thing that Cuba has is that everyone is equally miserable except for the top leaders. People are poor, no matter what color they are, no matter what their religion is or anything else. Everybody's broke, and everybody's trying to get out. I don't think that's a great alternative.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think the way that communism has been carried out in Cuba is not I would agree that's not a great alternative.
I don't think it's really been very successful for the people anywhere it's been tried. If you look at how people are treated in China, how the Uyghurs are treated in China, how the average person is treated in China, how it goes in Vietnam, how it went in the Soviet Union, I just kind of think that there's got to be a different alternative. I don't think the profit margin is the problem. One of the things that I never saw in your book that concerned me was that the family began to be dramatically affected by all of these societal changes during this time, and the African-American family was incredibly stressed because fewer and fewer fathers were involved in the lives of their children. There's a societal aspect to this, too, that when the family falls apart, then eventually the neighborhoods fall apart and the community falls apart. And it just seems like there was not, for whatever reason, it doesn't seem like, and maybe not having good jobs for people is part of the reasons that families fell apart. But it seemed to me that there's a continuum that goes right along with all these other losses and breakdowns in society, always involves the breakdown of the families. And I don't think throwing away the profit margin is going to affect that. I think helping families to get stronger is going to go a long way.
Yeah, I definitely heard that in my interviews, people mentioning that people who had been incarcerated for 20, 30 years, explaining how that had affected their family and it had affected their ability to connect with their sons. You know, so then it creates intergenerational destruction of the family. That's definitely something very strongly felt in Washington, D.C., where we have the children of the era of mass incarceration. So in 1997, 50% of people in Washington, D.C., 50% of young black men in Washington, D.C., were caught up somehow on the carceral web. And then their children, of course, are, you know, face the consequences of that. Not just the person who is convicted of the crime is punished, but also the whole family. And so there's definitely family consequences to how we treat people.
We've got to do a better job helping families. And I don't know if that means tax credits, some sort of support systems for families that are trying to stay intact. There's got to be something that can be done to help them, that's for sure. But I do appreciate that you are alerting all of us to the fact that if we just thought everything was peachy in Washington, D.C., except for all those crazy people running things, bad news, D.C.'s in trouble. And part of the reason that they're in trouble is that they don't really have any real autonomy, and something desperately needs to be done about that. What can we do to encourage people to invest in businesses and so forth?
D.C. We have a law that says, you know, there's supposed to be racial equity in all of our investment decisions. So, but that law hasn't been fully, you know, enacted or implemented. I mean, it's enacted, but it hasn't been fully. There's not a lot of accountability for that.
Yeah.
So, kind of keeping an eye on our actual racial equity plan and making sure that we commit to at least what we said we were going to do with regard to racial equity in the city, because there's still tremendous disparities.
I appreciate the fact that you have made us aware of the problems that the district has. And do you live in the district now? Or?
Yeah, I do.
Well, thank you very much. Is there anything else that you wanted to talk about that I didn't get around to asking you?
No, I just want to offer one reflection. I agree with you that there has been a lot of devastation in many communist countries, but I think one thing we forget is there's also a tremendous amount of devastation in many capitalist countries. So as we think about, you know, what economic system is benefiting the most people, I think we want to remember the tremendous deprivation in countries like, you know, Niger, countries like the Congo, except Botswana, those places where capitalism is also not doing that great for people.
Yeah, one reason that the Congo had problems is that Belgium deliberately set tribes that had never been antagonistic, set them against each other, so that when the Belgium pulled out, the Congo would go up in flames and they'd have to step back in and look like the saviors of the Congo. I think colonization was a terrible thing, and they were among the worst of the colonizers.
Definitely.
Tanya, thank you so much for joining us. Do you have a website where people can go for more information about this book and your other books and about the Washington Center of the University of California?
Absolutely. My website is racismcapitalismlaw.com.
Racismcapitalismlaw.com. No hyphens or anything like that.
Mm-mm.
Hey, thanks for the good dialogue.
I appreciate it, Dave Kirby. It was great to chat with you.
Our thanks again to Tanya Maria Golash Boza, the author of Before Gentrification, The Creation of D.C.'s Racial Wealth Gap, from the University of California Press. You can check their website, ucpress.edu. You can check her website, racismcapitalismlaw.com. Isn't it interesting to get to talk to people who don't always agree with you about everything, but see, we can have a civil discussion about it. Would that the legislators in D.C. would be that way, and would that they would care a little bit more about the citizens that surround them in the district. We'll see you next time right here on your favorite radio station and your favorite podcast on thebookshelf.podbean.com. Until next time, I'm your host, Dave Doc Kirby. Thanks for listening, and God bless.